Welcome back to Art About.
Show about art, produced by Sally Bayou and controlled behind the desk by Sally Bayou, and therefore a work of art in itself.
Yes, not so well today. Am I on air? I can't tell.
I can hear you perfectly.
Can you?
I can hear you
good.
And see you.
Oh, that's marvellous.
You look lovely.
Thank you so much. Welcome to another Sunday morning discussion about things that interest us with artist in residence and cultural sounding board John Baird, the fabulous and poetic Mark Stewart, and me, Sally Bayliew. How is everyone?
Good. I'm well. How are you, Mark?
I'm very well. Well, more or less for a Sunday morning.
Oh,
just back from mass.
Just back from mass, on it. Of course you are. John, what have you been doing today and what have you got on for us this week?
I've been doing this today, and today I'm going to talk about an American artist called John Graham, who isn't very well known but was had a fair bit of clout in American. He's perhaps the father of AbEx.
Of what?
Abstract Expressionism.
Oh, what did you call it? AbEx.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's a cool way of saying it.
Yeah, I disagree completely, of course.
But I'm also going to talk about the odd way in which I came to know about this fella.
Okay, very good. What about you, Mark?
I'm going to talk about some terrible shows I saw at Level 3 in Fed Square.
Okay.
All, unfortunately, women, but we'll get over that. And I'm going to read some poems, apparently.
Yes, you are going to read a poem. Well, of course, we had a great night at the Poetry Corner this week, didn't we?
We did,
which
yes.
You missed out on, John.
Sorry.
Yeah. It is a pity because it was fantastic. Alan Pentland was something else, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he really is. We had him on the show a couple of weeks ago. He was really, really brilliant. And I really enjoyed the fact that he had a violinist, Jason,
yes.
playing with him. That actually
yes.
added a really lovely,
a lovely
dimension
touch.
To it, wasn't it?
Yes.
So you're going to do a poem for us too. Well, you performed, of course,
yes,
left
I
everybody
did.
With their jaws scraping the tabletops, I think. It was rather spectacular. Well, I think that they were aghast in some ways at the nature of the poetry.
Which was a little slightly erotic. Is that
it was
what you're
very
saying?
Erotic, yes.
Very, yes, it was a love poem.
I know, it's a yes. wonderful poem. It yes. was actually really fabulous. But I think it was. It took the listening audience a little by surprise, don't
yeah,
you think?
When you yeah. say everyone,
yeah.
How many people were there?
Well, the place was full. It was sold out. My guess would be there would be 50 or 60 there, perhaps.
Okay.
Would that be right, Mark?
And that was the youngest of the people as well.
I was the youngest.
You were.
But it was a fantastic night. So that was the last one for the year. They're going to be doing a few more. I think they don't start until March next year.
I think what was lovely was the fact that anybody can get up and read something. And it was so heartfelt.
Yes, it was.
Very much so. And I hear that actually you're going to get up and read something next
year. I think
year,
I so. Might next yeah. time. I think I'll prepare a little piece of poetry and do it myself. That'd be fun.
You're going to get Nick to come down and play the violin while you're doing that?
What a brilliant idea. Although it is a bit copycat.
It is a bit.
Yeah, I might have to think of something else. Today on the program, we're going to be talking with the director of the Midsummer Festival, Daniel Sangiatelli, and he's going to talk to us about that incredible festival, Midsummer, that blasts off on January the 14th and runs over 3 weeks all across Melbourne, celebrating the diversity of culture emanating from the LGBTQIA communities across Melbourne. Stories and artistic imaginings of these culturally underrepresented groups have not had a platform that they deserve until recently, and this fast-growing festival has been riding this wrong for a few years and has grown into an enormous event representing over 170 works from all walks of artistic endeavour to over 200,000 Melburnians, I think, this year. So we're going to hear a little bit about that. So while I get him on the line, here's a track by Indina Mezel and Tracy Thomas called Take Me or Leave Me. The annual celebration of queer, intersex, transsexual, transgender, bisexual, lesbian and gay culture Midsummer is held in Melbourne during January and February, including visual arts, theatre, spoken word, cabaret, film, live music, parties, sport, social events and public forums. Midsummer provides connection and belonging in safe, inclusive places. enabling shared experiences in a world that until now has underrepresented stories and points of view from this wonderful, diverse and crazy element of our culture. Beginning as a one-week celebration of Gay Pride in 1989, the festival has expanded to become a three-week event attracting more than 100,000 people to its opening carnival alone. And along with New York, San Francisco, Vancouver and Sydney, Melbourne's Midsummer is considered to be among the top five festivals in the world celebrating sexual diversity. As you might imagine, the yes vote last month will have added a big kickstart to this year's event. Go Melbourne! And as we saw in the numbers that voted yes, Central Melbourne was up there at nearly 84%. To tell us a bit more about the Midsummer Festival and perhaps tempt you there to experience some of it, Theatre Director and Festival Program Manager Daniel Santangeli is on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Daniel. Thanks for joining us on Outs About.
Oh, hi, Sally. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Daniel, if you were asked to describe Midsummer's mission statement in a sentence, what would it be?
Oh, that is a good question. I feel it's really difficult to beat your introduction of Midsummer Festival, to be honest. I think that was one of the most eloquent introductions of Midsummer I've ever heard.
Oh, goodness, that's good. Thank you for that.
I would say, for me, Midsummer is really about empowering queer voices. And I think, as you said earlier, often queer voices are left out of the mainstream conversation. And then when we even look at within queer culture as well, it's often there are particular voices within the queer community that are left out as well, particularly when we think about, you know, people who are queer but also live with disability, or people who are queer but also culturally diverse, or people who are queer but are also senior citizens, are often kind of left out of the kind of currency of the conversation. And I think for Midsummer, what's really important is that we think really broadly about all of the different cultural voices that are out there. And we work really hard to find the best of those cultural voices who are presenting the best art and presenting them in our festival. So that's kind of what I think about when I think about what our mission is as an organisation and as a festival.
Now, there are 170 events with apparently the involvement of over 500 culture makers in over 100 venues across Melbourne next season. That is one hell of a program to manage. Tell us a little bit about your team and how the event comes together each year.
We are a tiny team. So I'm one third of a full-time staff.
One third of the full-time staff, are you?
Yeah.
Good
so people often imagine that Midsummer is quite a large beast of an organisation, but we're actually quite small. And what happens, like with all festivals, our staffing gets bigger as we get closer to the festival with, you know, casual staff and contract staff. But then really at the heart of Midsummer are our volunteers. So we have about 300 volunteers that work on the festival, and we currently have a call out open for volunteers. And they really are the lifeblood of our organisation, because they're the ones who roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty, so to speak, and when it comes to actually delivering the events themselves. And I think with Midsummer, we operate all year round. So we don't just produce the festival. We also produce development programs and talks events. The vast majority of our program are made up of events that are produced by the LGBTQIA plus community. And then there are about 10 events out of the 170 that are part of the festival that are produced by Midsummer. So they're events that we've recognized, that we've built ourselves and gone, oh, there's a voice missing from the festival that's not coming through the open access. Of the program,
yeah.
That we go, oh, we need to make a particular space for this community because they're not coming through the open door of the open access program.
I wondered that actually. It sounds very much like a fringe model, which I was going to ask you, is it open access? And then, of course, you have the curated hub. Have you got an artistic director? Is that who decides what is missing and what it is required to flesh out the program?
Yeah, so as program manager, that's a big part of my job, is to engage with different queer communities and talk to them about whether they think they see themselves in Midsummer Festival, and then if not, about how they might like to engage. So it's really a conversation, an ongoing one that happens throughout the year, And already, even for the 2019 festival and the 2020 festival, it seems crazy to be saying that, but already having conversations, because I think for some communities, the road to kind of get them to have a cultural voice is a long journey. So we really do work year-round supporting our artists, so even the ones that we produce, but also the ones that come through the open access model. Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time talking to those artists and producers about everything from their media releases and how they could look better, all the way through to their events. If they're saying, oh, I really need a stage manager, or, oh, I didn't get the rights to my play, what do I do? We're there to support them in that as well.
Fabulous. Now, 170 events, you can't possibly tell us about very many of them, but I'd love to hear about a few that you've got coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think one really exciting event that we have coming up is an exhibition at the State Library Victoria. So this is one of those events that Midsummer is producing, and we're doing it in partnership with the State Library and also with curator Angela Bailey. So Angela Bailey is an expert when it comes to archives, and particularly when it comes to queer archives. So she is one of the leaders at the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. And so we're working with her as a curator to present an exhibition at the State Library where we've commissioned five contemporary artists to dig into the archives at the State Library and find some queer narratives that exist within the library's archives. It was really shocking for me when I found out that if you type in queer or gay or trans into the database at the State Library, nothing comes up.
Oh, right.
So there are a lot of hidden narratives in those archives. Things that if you know how to look, if you know what you're looking for, you'll go, okay, there were two women that was in that house in the early 1900s, and there was only one bedroom. Okay, that tells me something. So some of the artists that we've commissioned to present in response to the archives are artists like Australian Aboriginal artist Peter Wapples Crowe. We also have Archie Barry, who's a young trans artist who's just graduated from BCA, who will be presenting a work and also does these kind of quite wacky performances as part of their video work as well.
So at the State Library... Sorry, I beg your pardon.
Oh, that's right.
So at the State Library, these artists are also presenting their work. Is that what you are implying?
Yeah, that's right. So these artists are exploring the archives, and then at the State Library in their Palmer Hall will be presenting their works in response to the archives. So and that exhibition is running from the 9th of January to the 1st of April.
Oh, so that's running out of, a long time.
Yeah, so it'll run actually beyond the date for the festival as well.
There's also, of course, you have the Pride March, which is on January the 28th.
Yeah, that's right. So Midsummer Pride March happens in St Kilda and goes down Fitzroy Street. That's a really incredible event that happens. Midsummer's been running the Pride March for about 4 years. We inherited it as an event when the organising body of that about 5 years ago folded. And for us, it really is the kind of crown jewel of Midsummer Festival. It's a really unique opportunity for so many diverse queer communities and allies to come together in March. And really at the moment, we're waiting to find out what's happening with marriage equality. One of the things that we've kind of got up our back in our back pocket at the moment is if marriage equality happens, then we'll be looking at doing a call out for couples who might want to actually get hitched at Pride March.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, which would be incredible.
Yes.
So, we're just watching with bated breath at the moment to see what happens, and hopefully by the time this goes to air, we'll have an answer.
Fingers crossed for that one. Now, of course, the festival starts off with a carnival, doesn't it? Which is a big family day in the Alexandra Gardens.
Yeah, that's right. So, Midsummer Carnival is in Alexandra Gardens. It's on the Sunday, the 14th of January, and kicks off the festival. We have about 100,000 people attend that event throughout the day. It's completely free. Lots of people come, bringing their own picnics. And for that event, there are several stages in several different areas. And I think one of the things that we pride ourselves with that event is that there really is something for everyone. So, you know, there's a dance party that's part of that event. There is also a family area as well. So we'll have drag queens doing reading stories to kids. We'll also have a chill-out zone as well and an area for people who are under 18, which is an alcohol-free space run by Minus 18. I think that's one of the things that we really enjoy about that event is that it really is for everybody.
Well, it definitely gives a taste of the breadth of the program. The website shows an incredible breadth of material that's out there. There's something for absolutely everybody. There's cabaret, there's young people, there's talks, there's music, there's parties, there's nude pool playing, there's all sorts of it. It really is a remarkable program and looks like an awful lot of fun. Midsummer Festival begins this coming January the 14th all over Melbourne, bringing with it a celebration of diversity and inclusion and a plethora of stories and experiences to enlarge your world. It sounds as if there's something for everybody, and it's a great reason to get out and a little more versed in the views of others. Tickets, information, and of course the program guide is on the website. I'll put links on our Facebook page. But many, many thanks for talking to us, taking the time to talk to us today, Daniel Santangeli. It's been wonderful, and good luck with the festival. It looks like a really great time to be in Melbourne.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Sally.
Great pleasure. See you soon. Okay, so I think the time has come now. Mark, you're going to read us a poem or a couple of poems,
aren't
you?
Well, yes, John has been badgering me to read again because he loves my poems.
We all love your poems.
You know, especially John,
as to half of the Southern Peninsula now, Mark.
Well, I noticed, Mark, this is a barefoot poem, this one. You've taken your shoes off before.
I suffer from hot feet, amongst other things, John. So this poem's called Quiet Corner, which many people who lived in Bayside might know Quiet Corner. I had the pleasure of living there for a while.
Are you allowed to tell me where it is?
It's between the clock tower of Black Rock and Ricketts Point.
Okay.
It's no longer quiet. It's only quiet in the middle of the night, or some magic moments between times, like Saturday evenings from 7 till 9. See, no, it's cars wishing to and fro, on missions of such deliberate direction, may nothing stand in their way except perhaps the bikes, those superannuated luminous lycra addicts, so many where before there were none, yelling at each other in the dark of morning, pedaling and whirling en masse, searching for endorphin hits, mustering up their rusty courage before beginning their tedious, mindless days. Then there are the runners, all dressed up too, dark glasses covering the early empty terror in their eyes, white plugs in their ears blocking out ambient sound, filling their heads with God only knows what horror as they run and they run from the second law of thermodynamics, entropy, themselves, until they run no more. Great positive poem, eh?
Oh, yes, that is a little bit miserable, isn't it? That's a railing against the world.
Well, I don't know. If you ever lived in Black Rock, you see there's a lot of very strange things going on there.
Do you think perhaps that's what they reflect on while they're running? Entropy or thermodynamics?
Well, probably not, but that's what they're dealing with, isn't it? Mm. Eventually.
They should think about what they're doing.
They should.
Well, they probably... What I've noticed is that they talk so much. All these guys on their bikes, they're just talking constantly. So there's some sort of... It really gets their communication going, this pedaling.
Yeah, they're just planning how to get in my way.
Mm. Okay, so before we run out of time, I've got another one called Apropos, which is about Paris. The word for cash in France is liquide, which is liquid. So it's a lovely word for cash. And this is before the euro. So the Pascals were the 500-franc note.
Oh, I remember that.
Because it had Pascal, the philosopher, on the 500.
Mm. One felt very fortunate to have one of those in your hand.
They were very popular with drug dealers. Mm. Anyway, so to begin, apropos, I sold a sculpture, half a black Belgian marble head for 6,000 francs. Liquide in Pascals. I left swiftly, passed through one of those quintessent Parisian autumn afternoons where the usual frenetic pace suddenly softens, everything shines and glints, angels pass, people pause and look up. There were no telephones then. I threw the Pascals so light to my love on her bed. She has eyes the colour of the evening sky, seen from a rear vision mirror, moving rapidly in the opposite direction. Her nose perfectly formed after 2,000 years trying. Her bottom teeth push out slightly, her lower lip constantly moist from an overproduction of saliva, and makes sweet sucking sounds to stem the flow. Her soft skin is keen, cool, pliable, edible, her 12-year-old breasts still forbidden fruits, her belly firm and round as a freshwater mountain lake, flowing down to that glorious center of gravity where metaphors disappear, art ceases to exist, life and death hover and mingle, struggling for precedence, then finally pass on to other things, like remembering.
Ooh.
Well, it was beautiful.
That was really incredible.
Yeah, that was for Katty. This was the beginning of the love poem. This is afterwards. It's a very short one.
Okay.
Je t'aime, mon amour. I went to your grave today. It's almost 4 months now. I'm remembering the sweetness of your saliva when in fact your mouth has surely completely disintegrated. I look up through the grey and see swallows floating by, signs, always the eternal belief in resurrection, in recognition of life continued. But no, nothing, only the salt of my tears to reconcile my memories of your beautiful little face under me, the crystals in your eyes as you whispered to me, je t'aime, mon amour.
Oh, that's beautiful, Mark. Beautiful. I sort of feel a betrayal having to turn on the ads now. Here we go.
That'd be good.
Let's set the scene, shall we?
Yes.
For my discovery of Ivan Dabrowski.
Ivan Dabrowski.
A.K.A. John Graham. I had a studio in Little Bourke Street in Melbourne, up on the fifth floor of an old building.
Were there ladders involved?
That is the building from which ladders protruded at times.
Over to the hardware club. Have you been on those ladders?
I don't know if I was around then.
No, you weren't around. And I need to describe the studio in order to set the scene properly, but I had, as if you've been paying attention, Mark, you'll know that I used to be able to get my car up there in a goods lift. So there was a large room with my Volkswagen parked in the corner. One wall was made out of office panelling, floor to ceiling, which was probably the original dividing wall in the floor of the building. And there was a large circus tent, which a friend had lent me, which had been used as a prop for the Barnum and Barnum theatre show. And they had this thing set up in the foyer, so you could go in there and buy programmes, I think, from someone dressed as a
lion tamer.
Yeah, or something. Yeah. And it was a beautiful thing, a stripy circus tent with a satin lining with gold stars all over it.
Sounds gorgeous.
Had my bed in there.
Oh.
And I would work with paintings on one wall and sit on the other side of the room with the back of the chair up against the wooden panelling. And I was sitting there one day looking at a painting, and I could hear in the studio behind me some furniture being dragged around. And then suddenly there was this like loud crashing, cracking sound, and the business end of a claw hammer kind of came through the wall, through the wooden panelling, and pinched a big hole in the wall. And I was just sitting there watching this happen, thinking, someone's breaking into my studio through the wall. But rather than that happening, it opened just enough for a copy of John Graham, Avatar, a book on John Graham, the artist, to come through the slit in the wall and drop to the floor next to me, and then the hole got closed up and the furniture shifted back into place.
You're joking.
So I picked up this book. I thought, oh, here's something to read.
The universe has delivered.
I don't believe a word you're saying, John.
So I had a look at this book, and I'd never seen any John Graham stuff before, and it was really quite interesting, and I was reading about him being the father of ABEX in America, according to the people who wrote the book, at least. And he was certainly a big influence on people like Ashiel Gorky and Willem de Kooning, particularly with that kind of whipping line that they were both heavily involved in. And they all used that little device, which is a thing called a flitch.
Which is what?
It's a brush with a short handle and a long bristle that signwriters use to get pin lining.
So it's sort of shaped.
You can flick it around and it'll make a kind of French curve.
What's it called?
A flitch. And they're all very fond of drawing with a flitch, so that rather than getting a steady line, they would get this kind of elastic, quivering sort of line all through their work. And I think it pretty much came from John Graham. And he was very practiced at it himself.
Is he an American or is he an
Well, he was a Russian. His name originally was Ivan Dabrowski.
Oh, I thought it went the other way around. I thought it was.
And he fought during the First World War in the cavalry, Russian cavalry, and then he joined the White Army after the war and fought the Reds. And they lost, of course. He went to prison for about 5 years and ended up in America, where he started making up fibs about who he was and where he came from.
Yes, and ultimately became John Graham.
Yeah. He thought he was pretty good, and he used to tell people how good he was. Anyway, I was looking at this book and I thought, well, it's interesting the way that came through the wall like that. One's curious, of course, to know why something like that would happen, Mark.
Well, definitely, if one can believe that did happen.
Yeah, it did happen.
It did actually happen.
So I went round to where the studio, the door to the studio behind me was, and I started knocking and shouting and hanging around, and I couldn't get any sort of response from there. And eventually I thought, oh, maybe this book is just on some sort of weird passage. So I wrapped it up in brown paper after I'd had a good look at it. Wrapped it in brown paper and I wrote "read" on it in black texture colour. And I took it over and I left it on the front doorstep of the ballet school over the road and thought, well, they might be interested to find that in the same way that I was interested to see it come through the wall. And on the way back up to my studio, I saw Erin, who it turns out was my neighbour, coming out of her studio. And I said, did you push that book through the wall? And she said, oh, I did. And I said, well, what's that about? And she said, well, actually, this is like a day later. And she said, actually, I thought that I was hiding it. I wanted to conceal it in the wall. I didn't know that it would go through to your studio. And I said, why are we hiding a book? And she said, I've just been commissioned to design a tram for the Metropolitan Tramways. And they were coming up to my studio yesterday to look at what I've been doing. And I'd copied most of it out of a John Graham book.
Oh, hilarious.
And I didn't want them to see the book. So she'd pushed it through the wall into what she thought was a cavity, but in fact was my studio.
It's a lot of work to go to. Why wouldn't you just stick it under the bed or
something? That's what I asked her. I said, why? There are many other alternatives to, like, breaking the wall open and pushing a book through.
Did you
but
see
as
the
I found out, she was not exactly a well-balanced human being.
Interesting, artistic, but not well-balanced.
Did you see the tram?
Yeah, I did see her tram, and it had a kind of a John Graham look about it.
Oh, funny. That's really good.
That's it.
That's it, Mark.
That's it.
Yeah.
I think I was going to play a bit of music. But
I could tell you a lot more about Erin, but we don't want to know.
No, okay. We don't want to know. But And John Graham, I must admit, I have never heard of him.
I'm going
to
look him up because I haven't
definitely worth a look.
Because my experience was that Hans Hofmann had a big influence on a lot of the abstract expressionist painters.
Well,
he was also a Jewish European who came to America. He didn't change his name. But he was a very influential...
Well, likewise, I'm not that familiar with Hans Hofmann either, but I think perhaps these people have been left behind because Greenberg had a particular little group of artists that he supported and anyone else was rubbish as far as he was concerned.
Yeah, that's very true. It was also an evolution, but these guys were the beginners and you know, Pollock and Rothko and the rest of them were just so sort of... massive in their taking over of the artistic scene in New York.
Although their admiration was directed at John Graham and probably Hans Hofmann as well.
Anyway, it's all finished, isn't it?
It's all over now, baby.
All over now, babe. Mm. Okay, so now we're dealing with something a little more contemporary, and that is there are four shows on at Fed Square,
right,
which I saw last Friday on the third floor. The first one is Del Catherine Barton, The Highway is a Disco. The Highway is a Disco.
The Highway is a Disco.
I don't understand.
Right.
It would have to be one of the worst shows I've ever seen.
Oh, my goodness.
Lots of breasts, vaginas, and very large bronze cocks, which are, you know, I think all this is good.
Oh, so they're sculpture.
There's sculpture as well, yes. Mm. There's sculpture, film. She's just done the whole thing. She's let it all out, and it's all over the place. Graphic, decorative, convulsive, and so immature. It's just unbelievable.
Well, I know that, Mark, that you and I both have a dislike for overload of information. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, look, it's very much the case. Because the one good painting that I responded to, obviously this is my take on you know, I'm not damning her completely, it's just what the feelings I got, which I am always very happy to express.
Yes.
And there was one good painting there. It was from 2005, and it was a portrait with no background. It was just a black background, and you could breathe. You weren't being, you know, it's the optics that she's dealing with, which I think are the big problems with her graphic paintings, that you've got all this background, which apparently she doesn't even do. She's got an army of slaves
Do
all that intricate sort of cobweb type work behind. She doesn't even touch it. Which
well,
is
why bother?
Neither here nor there. Why bother?
It'd be tedious, I'm sure.
Yes, I was told yesterday that the NGV, just by the way, is the fifth most visited museum in the world.
That's an incredible fact, isn't it?
And the most visited in the Southern Hemisphere, which I guess there's not a lot of competition, but...
Do you think that relates to Tony Elwood's directorship?
Tony Elstonwick is a great... as much as I dislike what he does, he's extremely successful in making a museum function.
Which I think he did in Brisbane before
he
came
Brisbane here,
didn't he?
He did in Brisbane first, and they made it into something really quite special, and he's doing the same with the NGV, as I hate it.
The blockbusters, as we know, are where they get their bread and butter, and... it's important that they do.
Yeah.
And really, I always think of that as being a situation where they sell tickets to people to have a look at shows that aren't always all that exciting. People pay to go and see them, and as a result, we can go into the gallery for
nothing.
That's
right.
That's very true.
And better that it is a big blockbuster like that than the cafe, you know, which is what sort of happens everywhere else.
Well,
the cafe is the thing that brings the money in.
A lot of museums are doubling the size of their cafes and their shops. But look, who cares? Mm. So, not me. The other person...
that you do care about.
I do care about. It is Louise Paramore, who's got a lovely name. Mm.
Yeah.
I think it's part of her success.
I know her stuff.
It's called...
You know her?
Oh, I know the work. Yeah.
Okay.
The Palace of the Republic. It's also on the third floor. I think they should be ashamed putting up a show like this.
Oh.
It's any Mardi Gras sculptor has more integrity than Louise Paramore,
who won the
Lawn Prize last year with some. It was a Peter's bear with a plastic chair on top of it,
And it has a large sculpture on the freeway.
That's
out
that horrible
of town.
Thing. That's that horrible
Which one?
Thing.
On
It looks like a pile of kids' toys on the bridge over the Frankston Road.
You go past it very often.
Oh,
yeah. It's got primary coloured balls and sticks and spikes.
Yeah.
And
yeah, hate that.
Hate it, exactly. Mm. So look, we're really getting into Louise here. She's
I don't mind it, actually. Oh. It sort of reminds me a bit of the Jetsons for some reason.
Oh. Oh. It's just, once again, it's something, the material itself is just dead. It's like Ron Muick's sculpture. It's dead.
I agree.
Well, it's not dead yet, but it's not going to live for long.
Badly.
You can see it rusting. It dies badly. That is a nice phrase.
Exactly. Yeah. Like what's her name? Deborah Helpin. Her sculptures die really badly. So anyway, Louise Paramore has got her paper cutouts. So there's a whole room of paper. There's about 10 years of her work in there. A lot of plastic pieces, bits and pieces she's collected. It is just a very bad show. There was no one in there. Then there's Helen Maudsley, who I've never heard of, but apparently she's fairly well known, is she? Do you know Helen Maudsley?
I don't know.
It's called Our Knowing and Not Knowing. It's a room of basically the same painting. It's all the same colours, same shapes. It's just monotonous. Absolutely no. I just don't understand it at all, why she's there.
Did she get someone else to make them, perhaps, as well?
No idea. I don't know anything about her. She's got a lovely name as well. And then there's Mel O'Callaghan, who born in Sydney but lives in Paris, and she's there's a also on level three large video with three firemen holding onto a powerful hose pointed at some guy battling against the water.
Oh yeah,
and it's he's getting a bit wet, and it's supposed to be some sort of
so
struggle.
It didn't
struggle.
Speak to you.
Look, the video itself was, you know, by itself in a big room was after all the other stuff was actually quite relaxing. But for me, videos are very difficult to look at. I don't watch television. I find videos difficult to sit down and look at in a museum.
That's you because you're a minus 1% of the population.
Well, no, the only video artist I respect is Bill Viola.
Oh, yeah.
It begins and it ends there. He's the only one who's done anything which has any meaning.
Bill Viola.
Yeah.
Oh.
Who you look him up.
Is he French?
No, he's American. He's the one who did the large video of a baby being born, his mother dying, and him standing under a shower of water. So it was, and he does fire as well. He's quite well known. Look him up. They're quite touching.
Okay, so that wasn't a good excursion for you. That was a bad day. I think it's an
example of the all-inclusive idea of getting people in who shouldn't perhaps be there. Yeah. No matter what their sexuality or their gender.
Are you aware, Mark, that I made a video once called Lunch? I completely stuffed it up technically.
Mm.
And I had no control over the equipment at all, didn't know what I was doing, and it won a video festival. It's called Lunch.
Yeah, you've told us that story. That's hilarious. Well, did the camera fall over or...?
Everything happened. Yeah. Everything went wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to seeing it at the NGV one day, John.
Yeah, it'll be up there one day.
So, look, please, everybody, go and see these four lovely women.
Yes, and see whether or not you agree with Mark.
See what you think. Yeah. We can get something serious.
Did you go back into Gareth Sampson?
I went past there and I looked at them and I thought, I did look at them. It's a lovely exhibition. But once again, too much stuff.
Yeah.
There's a bit of restraint. Doesn't seem to be much restraint these days. It's like letting everything out, and there's very little subtlety. It's a very sort of immature world, I think, artistically.
Well, it's not only in the art, but in the world in general, I think, is lacking in grace these days. Mm. It's become
depth of thought.
Mm.
Well, yes. So
just think about that, Mark.
Well, no, I agree, John. But then I think, well, you know, we're at that age where we can speak like that, and I just think we've got to be so careful of it, because you look at all these sort of LGBT GTI 350s or whatever they are, and all their sexual identities, their identities through their sexuality, through their gender. I don't understand it. I think, why can't you just have all that and be? Why does it have to be up in people's faces? Is it because...
Well, I've been thinking about that because you mentioned that a little bit earlier, and I think that there is a case for it, because I think that if you found yourself unrepresented in any art or any...
All my life.
Well, not really. That's not true.
Well, it is true.
Why? How is that true? Why because are you not represented in...
Because I'm not part of the scene. I'm not part of the circus. I'm not... It's not something I've never been really represented by a major gallery.
But you've had a very interesting life. You are a white heterosexual male who has had a privileged life in many respects. If you compare your circumstances to many other peoples in the world, and you see yourself or representations of people like you in art and in media and on television, in sculptures and so on and so on. And if you don't ever see a representation of yourself anywhere, I can imagine that would be very disillusioning and would cut you off and would make you very angry. So I think that there is a great reason to...
So then what, you have to be represented by your sexuality? By...
Well, no, but that is surely a part of it. I mean, when you're looking at films, for example, and you see people's lives portrayed in a certain way, and there's no point to the way people are represented in films, and yet that is just sort of an ongoing representation of what is the truth and what is real. So if you don't see yourself or the way that you live or anything represented in some of those things, then I think that you would feel displaced.
Well, then that's definitely the case. For me, I didn't see myself represented in anything which was going on in society around me in the 70s, and one of the reasons I became an artist was because I was pulling myself out of the society. I thought it was just a load of, I thought it was very confusing in many ways. Mm-hmm. I didn't agree with the corporate world. I didn't agree with the sporting world. I thought it was all a load of rubbish. I thought people were just completely wasting their time. But I didn't feel as if I needed to be a part of something else. I just thought I'd just go and discover something myself. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's got nothing to do with what's going on now, which is this whole sort of gender and sexual identity. It's a movement which is very interesting, but I don't understand. I know people want to be represented. Mm-hmm. We all want to be represented in some way. But does it have to be now?
Well, why not? Why not now? If it hasn't, it wasn't before, so it's got to be sometime.
I saw a very interesting show in London of art. I've spoken about this before, of artists who were very famous in their time and who were completely forgotten about now. Often the case is that if you're so much involved in your time, then you disappear afterwards.
Because you're not relevant out of your time.
Because this is it. You become so much a part of something which is, as you might realize, things change so quickly. They go from, you look at the way the Melbourne's changed from just in our time, the art world, a movement lasts maybe 5 years, 6 years, no longer. It's already changing. Mm-hmm. And this whole contemporary art movement, it's already dying. It's finished. We've got to move on to something else. And we will. Mm. It will happen. But it's people don't realize that if you get it, you get too much involved in the time you're right at the moment, then you just disappear into it.
Mm. I do agree though that there is that this is a step in changing a culture.
Changing a culture, but it's one could wonder whether or not we're becoming more segregated rather than more global.
That's very true, John. Yeah. And there's a lot of confusion. I mean, there's sexual confusion about these kids being given the possibility of being trans or not trans. I feel for them because it's such a job to be, to change your sexuality must be such a lot of hard work.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, Andy Warhol was talking about this. They said, Jesus, these guys, they've got to shave all the time. They've got to take all these drugs to...
You mean changing sex rather than sexuality?
Well, yeah, transgender sexuality is not so difficult.
Hark! It's time for the news. We've got a very quick one today. We've got a call out from the Shire for emerging and established artists. Writers, musicians and creatives are invited to apply for an artist residency in the Gatekeeper's Cottage at Police Point Shire, Portsea, from July next year through to June the following year. So applications are open. They're open now for supported and fee-paying residencies ranging from 2 to 6 weeks.
So anyone who thinks they can use that should go down there and use it.
It's a very sad place. It doesn't have a good vibe about it.
Oh, I think it's beautiful.
I think there's been a murder down there. I think
really?
Something's happened.
Well, there are a whole lot of people who died down there.
Well, I had a fair bit to do with that getting up and running.
I know, John. That's a good thing.
I'm rather pleased with it.
But you can't get rid of the massacres behind it. There's something happening. Anyway, the artists, it'll be good for them and get them thinking.
Yeah. Baluk's last public workshop for the year is one for the men. This is for you, Mark, not women. Join Lionel Louch for hands-on didgeridoo playing workshop. What about that? If you're interested in that, I think it's on Saturday the 9th of December. Contact Baluk Arts down in Bruce Street in Mornington.
I meant to bring in a copy of The Leader, which had a front page the other day. Would you pay $200,000 for this? And a photograph of the new sculpture on the foreshore at Rosebud.
Oh, yes, those wings of the pier timbers. I rather like them as well. I particularly noticed them a couple of days ago.
I haven't seen
them. And they had a list of other things you could get for $200,000, amongst them a new toilet block.
Oh, well, I'm glad they put the sculpture there, actually.
It's terrible they should speak about money like that.
It is.
But that's just a journalist who's an idea.
Yeah.
Okay, I have no idea where we are here.
Okay, then I'll read another one. The Ninch Festival is on the 13th of January. Tickets are on sale already, and I have a link on our Facebook page.
There we go. Harold Hatton's work is on at Eastgate Gallery in Burwood, Hawthorne, until December the 13th. There's a link up to that too.
Yeah, that's on the Facebook page as well, and you get a chance just to have a look at the work of John's obstetrician. John's indeed. Delivering obstetrician.
Indeed.
If you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About, we'd love to hear from you. Oh, I might... if you visit our Facebook page, you'll find links to some of the things we're talking about on the show and also get a reminder about what and who's coming up in the next show. Our Facebook page links on the RPP website. So join us again, 11 a.m. next Sunday.
Podcast the past, yeah. I reckon too. That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, that's right. Just look at me, I'm struggling to handle all the knobs. And remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art.
We're going to Geelong and see if we can find something out.
Oh, yeah, we will too. That'll be good.
The Archibald, yes. And get to Fed Square, level 3.
Have a look.